Joining us this week on To FinTech and Beyond, the podcast brought to you by Tribe, is CEO of ClearBank, Charles McManus. Today we're doing a Tribe first and bringing you a face-to-face podcast here from my home with a view to talking about how you can scale a fintech without breaking it and all of the interesting, exciting nuances of embedded banking. Hello and welcome to another episode of To FinTech and Beyond, brought to you by Tribe Payments. Today we're doing a Tribe first, our first ever face-to-face podcast. So I'm delighted to welcome Charles McManus, CEO of ClearBank, actually into my dining room. So Charles, welcome.
Absolute pleasure. Lovely to be here.
I think the big question we're going to focus on today is how you can scale a fintech without breaking it. A bit of an introduction to yourself, your background, and how you came to be here today.
Absolutely. Delighted. So I've been in, sounds forever, doesn't it? 35 years in investment banking, wealth management banking, and have gone through the, if you like, the more normal route. Qualified with KPMG, headhunted to actually join Hambros. I grew up in the merchant banks, actually, at Hambros, and lived through the Barings crisis and the whole world of banking changing post-Barings and then Big Bang. And I was COO of our treasury and capital markets business when Hambros was sold to SocGen. And we built a very successful fixed income business in Rand and Kiwi and Aussie. And we convinced the French that they should sell it rather than merge it and destroy it. And so we ended up with NAB in Australia, Chase as it was then, and Royal Bank of Canada. And we sold the fixed income business to RBC, the investment bank. I went with it and with RBC Capital Markets for 13 years all around the world, again through another financial crisis. And I was then coming towards the sort of end of my banking career. I was on the way to Hong Kong to run Asia for them when I got headhunted by Stephen Hester to go and clear up either the Irish mess in RBS or non-core. And I took the Ireland assignment for 2 years. And of course, Ireland then went through its financial crisis as Stephen Hester was trying to recover. Did 2 years, came back from there and semi-retired, got various property interests on the recovery in Ireland and others. And it was former head of equities at RBC that said, Charles, go and have lunch with one Nick Ogden. And Nick had this crazy idea of a new clearing bank. I did 3 months DD. I said to my wife, well, I'll do it for 2 years. And I'm now 6.5 years in, and the opportunity now is bigger than when we started.
And that doesn't look like slowing down either.
No, it's not. As I'm sure we'll talk about international expansion and the rest, but we're having an amazing time in servicing all our clients and growing in the clearing and settlement embedded banking space.
Which I think brings us nicely on to embedded banking. So I think we wanted to talk a bit about that today, but just generally, how do you define embedded banking? What is its importance in today's financial society?
It's a passion of mine in that you've seen payments on behalf of other regulated entities, whether credit unions, banks, Bill and Sarty, EMIs, and from doing clearing and settlement to offering more of those capabilities essentially to our fintechs and other customers. And the first wave of that has been banking as a service. So that expression, overused in terms, can be anything to the bank in a box and software and all of that. We don't use the word BaaS, we use the word embedded banking, and there's a clue in the banking word in that we are trying to allow our fintech customers, or indeed any customers, that haven't got a banking license to behave as if they have one with their customers.
Yep.
And what does that actually mean? It's essentially embedding our bank account in their front-end app.
Okay.
So whether you're in savings or SME banking or you're a crypto exchange or any business and rather offer your customers a prepaid card solution or whatever, what about an FSCS protected proper bank account?
Yeah.
That's then embedded in your front end. So you click on the T's and C's for the fintech and then you click on the T's and C's for a ClearBank bank account. It pops up and then you operate that through the front end.
Brilliant.
So that's what we call embedded banking and all the services that are around. But what are we actually doing? They're effectively outsourcing and renting our banking license to be able to offer those services.
And there lies the need, ultimately. These fintechs need a banking functionality to grow
exactly.
Their business.
Exactly, so yeah. That they can actually give a much richer, deeper customer experience.
Yeah.
Rather than lay them off somewhere else, actually offer them more as the one-stop shop. And allow them essentially to get all of the services they need and get more integration, more real time, less friction, yeah. SLA, et cetera, et cetera.
So that's an interesting thing. So in terms of the needs, it's around focus on your customer proposition, not the banking pieces of the stuff that we can deal with. You need to focus on UX, UI, customer adoption, profitability. Maybe, you know, that's becoming more of a common theme at the moment. But do you think, therefore, they're the drivers for the use of someone like ClearBank, this time efficiency, this differentiation of services?
Absolutely. And if we go back a bit in relation to the that we've seen in the main trends, COVID, of course, right? So checks, cash, everything real time and being able to operate remotely.
Yeah.
And all the challenges we had, we ran the bank essentially for, because we're on cloud native, we've always been essentially real time cloud technology. We can run the bank from anywhere.
Yeah.
And we proved that for the 2 years. But of course, what did that do? That drove the need for digital transformation and digital payments much faster. McKinsey obviously talk about, you know, 10 years of change in 10 months.
Yeah.
And the scramble essentially in the old channels and distribution networks and tech wasn't good enough in that environment. And so we had an amazing time of really transformation, of helping those clients get their tech stacks where they needed to,
yeah,
to operate digital transformation. And it's really gone on from there. Now we've got, of course, the economic, the financial crime, the Ukraine-Russia challenges in relation to onboarding, KYC, PEPs, sanction screening, all of that, as well as the economic challenges. You've got to have the right tech and the right cost base,
yep,
to actually survive. And that is really driving ClearBank's success in empowering all of those to actually make that change and develop their business. And as you rightly say, Alex, focus on their customer propositions and not, yep, worry about the last mile and reconciliations and friction and mess,
yep,
that doesn't help them move forward with their customers.
So then taking, hopefully we can say COVID is now in the past to a large extent, or certainly,
absolutely,
the pandemic.
Yeah.
What does the next 12, 24 months look like for this space, do you think?
We think that's where the market is. And you move to a global basis, you now, and again, with terminology is quite important, but instead of being outside of embedded banking to embedded finance and that whole market, again, the estimates that that's a $7 trillion marketplace in relation to providing those services.
Wow.
It is a massive addressable market on a global scale. And you'll see you know, various BaaS players in the US. You'll see various fintechs that are actually sort of scaling to offer those services wider and deeper in relation to it. And you can see big tech and platforms, right? They don't want to have banking licenses, but all the Amazons and Facebooks and they're offering bank accounts to their customers.
Yeah.
And stealing that market and getting a deeper, wider experience with their customers, or value add, and if you like, retaining and attracting more, it's all about those capabilities. And so that's why we are expanding internationally, and a number of our customers are global. They want those services to the highest standards,
yeah,
and technology across the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it is still a very mixed marketplace in relation to, especially once you're getting into Europe or the US, the quality of service and actually payment execution, real time, everything, they've got a long way to go. And that's, yeah, a real opportunity for us because that's the world we live in.
Yeah, we felt the same thing. Just the idea that actually Europe has been a very good proving ground for fintech, for technology, for regulatory trust, the ability to then take that knowledge, that information, that technology and deploy it elsewhere. We went through exactly the same thought process with our expansion. But coming on to expansion, or less expansion, but more scaling, and we went through this challenge of within our business of when it was the right time to make that call. What do you think are, when does a business scale up? We've seen VC downturn, we've seen potential, you know, troubles in looming in the market. So what would you think, I guess more for my learning as well as the people that, you know, the five people that might listen to this, but when does one scale up? Like, when does one make that leap?
It's such a good question. It really is. And it's so important. And I know a lot of people in relation to fundraising this and of when do you do your Series A and Bs and Cs and what's the right time as compared to what you need in cash flows. It is a great question because we wanted to go international faster,
Right.
But actually, we delayed it and put more in terms of establishing ourselves in the UK before we actually of scaling. We saw it in the early days with our early customers that once certain fintechs got to, it was funny, it was 250,000.
Okay.
Fintechs could grow in terms of their customer acquisition, but there was like a step change, a real change that in their own scalability, they hit tech walls and scaling and step functions.
Yeah.
So they could grow to that size, but then couldn't go beyond that without major reinvestment or retooling it or sort of scaling. So getting ahead of that and thinking about that is really important rather than actually it become a real problem and delay and friction while you sort it out to then go again. But if you take ClearBank's experience, we decided that we'd rather put more energy in actually building deeper, wider relationships with our existing customers and being successful in the UK before we've gone abroad.
Sustainable business. Ultimately.
Absolutely. And the other aspects in sustainability is we never got into the race of just customer acquisition and buying business and not worrying about the P word. We have never, right from the start, not going for the sexy valuations and chasing the market or customers in relation to that. We'll only write profitable business to build a sustainable bank in relation to the infrastructure. And I think that's caught a lot of people out in relation to, as the markets change and the froth comes off, the liquidity of the market, all of that. If you haven't got the sustainability, you know, you're not good. You can't go abroad. You can't scale it.
I was reading only yesterday, I think, that Stripe have just laid off 14% of their workforce. Yes. And you look at the comparisons with someone like Adyen, they have a similar throughput, but there's 50% difference in number of staff. And, you know, I think there's been a very big focus in the industry of just hire and the revenue will come, as opposed to hire when the revenue is there to maintain and grow it. So
it's so true. I mean, I often talk about, if you like, yes, I'm an accountant at heart, but I'm and I've been in investment banking and trading floors sort of all my life and the rest of it. But I also consider I'm a risk manager. And the problem with founders, if you like, is exactly that. There's this inherent belief that you make it, you get the customers, and it will come right. And unfortunately, you know, core economics, gross margin, cost of goods sold in terms of COGS and all of that financial engineering of making it right, that discipline is so important.
Discipline is the word, isn't it? I think like there's just a common theme of, you know, pray. Let's just gamble again. We'll gamble it. We did it the first time. We got to 250,000 customers. Why can't we get to a million? Yes. Do you think there's going to be a bounce back? What do you think the investment landscape looks like for this ecosystem?
Undoubtedly, if you look at, say, VC or PE for a moment, a lot of focus now on of risk off and making your portfolio companies successful and really focusing and helping them get through rather than invest in you.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously is sort of a major impact and is filtering all the way through, I think, in relation to it. So with a new idea, finding VC and sort of startup like really, really tough. It's got to be so, so good and is so hard. And I know a number that I actually been helping in looking for it over a long period of time and have not been successful for quite good ideas. So that's really tough. In relation to having got investment and then focusing, the PEs, VCs focusing on making sure that their investment actually returns and helping them grow and survive through all the challenges, that is definitely going on. But like any shakeout, the weakest can't survive and won't survive the idea. And that's creating market opportunity, no question about it. So we know at the top end, IPO market almost closed. Private valuations, they can't realize valuations in the IPO market, so IPOs will be pushed out.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, how do they get the growth to justify the valuation? They're looking at consolidations, mergers, opportunities. So when the market comes back, they're then positioned to actually realize and the IPO market is open again. So I think we've already started to see it across Europe and the US and the rest. I think there's going to be some great market opportunities and you'll see a lot of consolidation.
Yeah. Yeah. I think which ultimately will be for the benefit of the ecosystem, I think.
Yes.
I think there's been this fragmentation of fintech has been great for development and innovation, but has also led to some questionable business models, perhaps, which have been ultimately funded by LPs or pension funds to a large extent.
That's so true. And again, of course, in go-go markets or whatever, and although all of us, in terms of sort of viewing regulation as a burden, when you look at what's happened with Wirecard and Wirex and safeguarding and EMIs where cash was not being properly looked after in a go-go market, you get the combination of that economic shakeout as well as naughty boys, bad actors in relation to not doing what they should do. And of course, that creates a regulatory clampdown and more cost for the minorities that don't behave. And again, that the cost of doing business actually goes up, but it sorts out those bad actors and behaviours.
Which I guess links us nicely back to what are the advantages of being a bank itself? Like you as a bank, EMI, we've talked about, you know, before we started this around interest rates and the opportunities, but you know,
A massive debate when we started, because very different cultures. I could talk about this for a while on the basis of, we talk about ourselves as being a fintech with a banking license.
Okay.
And how many times have you heard existing banks want to import more of the fintech culture into their traditional bank? The average age of our tech guys is what? And girls, 25. And they've worked at Just Eat. They've worked at all sorts of different places in terms of that. And then coming into a banking environment and have to do quarterly exams on KYC, AML, all of the banking stuff, which every employee of a bank actually has to do.
Right.
And so we've got our sort of compliance bits of the bank, and then we've got the true innovation sort of tech. How do you mix both of those into one team and actually create all that innovation and fintech culture? And we've been living that journey. But to answer your question, we view and I've been passionate about this from the start. Okay, I'm a banker. But in order to hold the cash and create the payment finality of real time for our customers, you've got to have a banking license in order to hold that cash, a Bank of England Reserve account, and actually process it through the payment schemes.
Yes.
And we didn't want to just be a tech provider in relation to good payments tech. And there are some very good companies that do out there. Then they've got to partner with a bank to do the last mile.
Yes.
We wanted to do the whole lot. At the same time, though, has been very focused on not doing the things that other banks do. So we don't do credit, for example. Right? All our cash sits 100% at the Bank of England.
Okay.
And our asset side of the book, there's no banking book or net interest margin or whatever it is, or AAA assets that are not AAA in a stressed, unwind environment. So we're one of the safest banks, if you like, putting it at the Bank of England. We are essentially there as an infrastructure payments provider, embedded banking provider. That's what we want to be. And we want to do that on a global. We don't want to do retail banking, business banking, lending, all of those things. We partner with others to facilitate all of that.
Yeah.
So in the payments world, and again, if you come back to offering bank accounts with FSCS £85,000 of protection to the likes of our customers of Tide and Chip, who are SMEs, you can only provide that if you are a bank.
Yes.
And those are the things that are so important when you see in digital asset space, retail, I would say investors, consumer, losing all of their 100% of their money, et cetera, et cetera. We're right at the other end of the spectrum. You put cash into a ClearBank bank account, you expect to get it back.
Which is almost a modernization of banking revenue streams, isn't it? Because we talked about this in conferences for years about net interest margin is still the way banks make money, and therefore, you know, fintechs will be drawn to that. But you've kind of disproven that theory through the use of technology.
Yes, that's actually, I've never looked at it like that before. You're quite right. I mean, all the cash sits at the Bank of England. We give a share back. A key aspect of our business was transparency. So all the large banking players, and there are cross subsidies, don't know what you're paying what for. Everything is transparent of our cost base and what we earn. Your cash overnight, Bank of England rate, which unfortunately now at 3%, and we'll give you a share of that back depending on how much you put. Complete transparency, charging you per transaction, an account fee for the services on the platform. And because we don't do credit, give us your cash to make a payment, and that cash is safe. Yep. So that's very much our model. When we go international, we'll have to do elements of credit to get the banking licenses. In the UK is quite rare in not. But we will crack that in terms of facilitation of helping payments by offering credit without damaging the whole, either getting into term lending or mortgages or anything like
that. How do you balance technology and regulation when maybe we've got all day for that question?
Really good. I suppose the cheat answer, but it's real, is operational resiliency.
Okay.
And so when you get into, you know, what do large customers want other than the real time and value for money and the right culture in terms of can do and business and innovation and everything else. We want you there 24/7, 365 in relation to uptime and not impacting our business model. The regulators have exactly the same. In fact, one of the things that I've consistently said to the bank when I took over this job at the start is that I never want to be in front of the Treasury Select Committee that our platform meant that a whole load of consumers couldn't use their credit cards, their debit cards, or whatever it was, and there's a mass outage, and ClearBank was responsible for it.
Yes.
And you've seen it with various tech stacks that have gone wrong. I was at RBS when their systems failed to happen and changed the world again. Our corporate clients were 10 days not knowing what their bank balance was and went bust. That cannot happen in terms of tech and systems and all of that. So, cyber, similarly, in relation to data breaches and GDPR, all really boring stuff. But when it goes wrong, the impact is so big to SMEs, retails, and the rest. So we want to operate at the very highest standards. And I've always said about regulation, right? A lot of it is common sense. We should be doing it in good business sense and then complying.
Yes.
As compared to just ticking boxes on regulation because we have to and it doesn't...
They should be symbiotic as opposed to...
Exactly. And that's the only way you can handle the cost and the... The cultural aspect is hard in that the whole SMR regime, governance, committees, documentation, because of what's gone wrong before, I now do go to prison and I become a bankrupt as a bank director.
Yeah.
When things go wrong, that drives a whole load of governance
stress.
And it's how you comply smart, clever, efficient while you get on executing the business, but complying at the same time.
We were talking about this over a croissant, I think we can tell. But the view that the technology needs to become regulated as it becomes, well, my view at least, but that we're such a critical part of the outsourcing ecosystem that it's just... It's crazy. So I guess you have that advantage of the oversight of the FCA, the PRA, that then allows you to preempt that.
And we've really worked on those relationships, especially in embedded banking, where we're overseeing EMIs on FinCrime, on customer onboarding, complaints, all of those things. Because ultimately we're responsible to those customers in relation to the bank account services that we provide through their platforms. We've learned an incredible amount in relation to all of that space. And we work very closely with the FCA and also, unfortunately, now in the last year, the National Crime Agency and all of those where some of our clients have been essentially impacted by bad actors getting into their accounts and systems and all of that. Lots of learning, but strengthening in terms of actually going forward, not as a more red tape, but just getting smarter and clever, the monitoring, the detection, the speed of actually operating and say in cyber security, for example, of that constant learning in relation to, you know, the UK, you only have to look at Ukraine and what Russia's up to and the rest. It is so important. You can be put out of business so quickly if you're not up to the highest standards and keep learning from every event that's happening every day, which is how Microsoft and all the players do it. Every attack anywhere in the world, they then update the global platform for that attack to stop it happening in
anywhere else. Country. Which makes trial by fire almost, isn't it? Unfortunately,
it's a challenging world out there to be sustainable. Well, as you say, right? Yeah.
I think we're you know, I think we've seen it in our business. This kind of expectation of you see these exponential valuations, and therefore, how do you not become one of those? And actually it's, well, actually you need to climb the staircase one step at a time. We only have a few more questions. I don't even know how long we've been talking, but around the success of a fintech. So whether it be in the UK, Europe, globally, whatever, like what do you think are the key pillars that one has to focus on now for success?
So I coming back to the P word and the S word and the rest of it, profit being a dirty word, don't think so. You know, sound discipline economics in fundamentals and building a successful, sustainable, profitable business, but really servicing your customers.
Yeah.
So rather than just customer acquisition and all about the top line revenues and the rest, obviously that shift is now well embedded in relation to that. So that is absolutely fundamental. Fintechs, and going back to the heritage of clean pieces of paper, innovation, doing it differently, smarter, and coming up with those ideas. That's what the UK has been so good at.
Yeah.
But those use cases actually being relevant and sustainable rather than a fad and a one-off. The rest are the table stakes in relation to it of you know, fundamentals, customer, right, or doing it, being able to outdo the others because of that tech stack and clean piece of paper, that you can actually really make a difference to your customer. Everyone talks about it and customer first, but fintech should be best placed to actually deliver that and really be able to listen and change fast to those demands. So obviously, relevance to the customer. And then again, the war for talent that's out there in terms of tech resources of people, the best talent. Everyone wants the best talent working in their company, et cetera. And to do that, you've got to be a brilliant employer culture. So first off, strategy plus economics, then very much people, culture, and I have a expression within the bank, all right, more my training throughout investment banking of execution. You've got to be able to move at pace and speed and be relevant.
Yeah.
And there's a massive race going out there in tech land and global domination in relation to embedded banking, as I talked about it. And I think there's only 2, 3, 4, 5 players that are actually going to win big in this market.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing those things, you're not going to be one of them.
I think relevance is such a key word in that focus, that sort of clear focus on delivery. The kind of, how do you actually ensure that there is a total addressable market for the product you want, and that actually people are willing to pay for that product? Yes. Because otherwise, to your point of strategy and profitability, or the P word, how can you ever achieve those if there isn't an opportunity to sell? We have one more tradition on this podcast where we ask each one of our guests exactly the same question, but it's not a trick. So hopefully, you know, so what are you having for dinner or anything like that? But we'd like to understand your views on what is the one thing in fintech that's yet to happen.
Yeah, and I obviously your listeners and the rest will know that. Given the question beforehand, so whereas it all should be ad hoc, and I just think of something and the rest, which is the best way of doing it. And yes, I put a little bit of thought into it and the rest, and it didn't really come up with a very good answer. I have got an answer in that they're, you know, if fintechs are doing their job properly, then all the things that the fintechs are good at should have already been done.
Okay.
So that's a cop out in relation to answer, because it's innovation, etc. So my answer was going to be somewhat more boring, but goes all the way back to maybe examples of where this has already been done. Part of the start and where we started, right? There used to be 16 clearing banks in the UK and got down to the big four.
Yep.
Legacy tech, fintech connecting to Barclays and Lloyds and the rest and ruining the customer experience. They're getting better and they're updating, but it's very slow and they're large and all of that. Has the landscape in terms of market share, has a fintech really penetrated the oligopolies and the market share and changed the landscape in terms of the big boys and girls? Now, you could say Revolut, right, is on its way globally in relation to some of the market shares it's achieved, but is it a household name that's really established in those markets and actually is going to, you know, is in the future years as compared to a Barclays or SocGen or Deutsche Bank, et cetera? Well, the fintech name is going to be part of that. And it's the cliche question of look at the tables now, who will be in the top 100 in 10 years time and the rest.
Like the FTSE or the NASDAQ, yes. Yeah.
And so have we seen the fintechs truly infiltrate those, the old ways, and become part of the new becoming part of the established and ongoing?
No, I guess not according to that Coachy report about, you know, fintech's percentage of GDV. But yeah, I think it's a good answer to the question, I think, because I think the innovation principles, I think we looked at fintech as a fragmentation exercise to start with, and we're starting to see a lot of that rebundling, and some of it will come through M&A and consolidation, but also that idea that the value chain is shrinking. But I think you're right, you know, there's a long way to go to be a core staple of global society. Yeah, thank you very much for your time. Like, it's been an amazing conversation. I'm told by both PR sides that we have to ask where we can find out a bit more about ClearBank, about yourself. I believe you've just released a report on this embedded banking function, so we should definitely push that so that people download it.
We absolutely have, because we're so passionate about embedded banking. We commissioned a piece of work. Go to our website, clear.bank. It's all there. And in terms of contacting me direct, LinkedIn, message me on LinkedIn, or indeed emails, all the normal routes in social media and the rest. But delighted to respond to any of your listener questions, reader questions, or anybody else. Thanks, Alex. Really enjoyed it.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for coming over to my house, in fact, and hopefully we haven't taken up too much of your Friday.
Absolute pleasure.